Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, yeah, a couple of weeks ago, we did an episode on Sue the Bastards, and I realized we're getting some feedback on that, as well as requests for updates. So what's going on with that?
It's a hot topic, Mark.
Tell me about it.
Well, quite frankly, you know, EB5 is, for the, as far as regional centers are concerned, is at a standstill because everybody is just busy and buzzing about this whole recertification. Well, from the last episode until this one, we do now have a form and instructions. And, well, there's still a lot. So I thought that we should have an episode to discuss where we are today, and a little bit of advice for practitioners who are really befuddled out there. So who better than David Herson from Herson & Partners? Welcome, David.
Thank you, Mona. Pleased to be here and look forward to giving whatever information we have, as little as some of it may be.
We're happy to have you back on, David. David's a repeat guest here on EB5 Investment Voice, but for those that don't remember David Herson, allow me to give you a quick intro. David has nearly 40 years of experience practicing immigration law with a particular focus on EB5. He's also the founding partner of David Herson & Partners LLP with offices in Costa Mesa, California, as well as Seattle, Washington. David, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mark. I'm glad to be here. And thank you, Mona.
So Mona, before we dive into this interview, it sounds like we have a form, we've got some good solid information, but not everything is out there yet, right? So we're going to focus on what we know and give particular advice to practitioners right now.
Yes, well, we're going to divide all of this up into parts, Mark. There's no way we could talk about everything in one episode, as you know. That's why we have 160 episodes on EB5. And there is still so much that we're waiting for as far as guidance.
Right. That sounds like a plan, Mona. We'll focus on what we know now, and of course, we'll have updates in the future.
David, I really want to jump in and ask you something, which right from the outset, I know it's a little unfair, but I really want your opinion. When the REIA was passed, that's the Reform and Integrity Act, Mark, when it was passed, Senator Grassley had a floor statement, which really made everybody wonder, because that floor statement had something of the effect of all regional centers will be cleaned out and everyone will start on a new, fresh slate. David, what is your opinion of such a statement? And do you think it's quite a hurdle to overcome the congressional intent issue?
Yes, I think it's a very important statement as it affects things going forward, because Senator Grassley was the architect of most of this law and he drove it for many, many years, although he wasn't in the lead party at this time.
Yeah.
And having done that, his view on what he thinks he's created, I think, carries a tremendous amount of weight. So if he thinks everything is starting from scratch with a clean slate, a lot of weight will have to be given to that. And I don't believe necessarily that credence will be given to all these other arguments or even the subsequent letters from the different congressionals saying this was not our intent. So we do have a problem to overcome over here.
I agree with you, actually, because from the outset, I did think that's what he wanted to do. And then it didn't make sense because I thought, how can they do that straight away? And I remember in the subsequent webinars after the law came out that one group focused on the fact that that was impossible. But really, truly, I do think it's not a bad thing. I think what, in my opinion right now, there's 650 or 660 regional centers, of which maybe 100 are active. And I don't think we are going to see 650 being recertified. I think we are just going to have 100 and maybe a few more new ones.
And I agree with you there. It's going to be a challenge to get new ones started. As far as starting fresh is concerned, the interesting issue is, what do you do with those cases that have been approved under the new law to go forward, having been filed before June 30, 2020? There will be no regional center for them if they choose not to go forward and recertify.
I know.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, I and that's the worry. One of the biggest worries about this whole thing was often the regional center is the arm to the from the in between the investors, the link rather between the investors and the job creating entity or the project. And many a time, investors have no idea. They've never spoken to the project. They don't know who the people are there. Their attorneys don't know. And we've seen that in a regional center here in New York, which suddenly, I'm not going to mention names, but it stopped really functioning. And it had a couple few projects. And then attorneys were calling me and asking me, say, hey, you're in New York. Do you know what's happening? Do you know how we can get in touch with them or the project? It was really frustrating. So I do hope that, you know, USCIS comes up with a policy or some kind of, I don't know, yeah, but maybe a policy that perhaps if a regional center is not going forward, those projects could switch to another regional center, but there has to be some obligation to cooperate.
Right. And that's where that inconsistency comes in from Senator Grassley's statement.
Yeah.
If everything's going to get cleaned out, he's envisaging that those projects will not have a regional center. And it's, in my opinion, going to create somewhat chaos. Alternatively, it will allow those projects just to finish quietly on their own, get their jobs done, and perhaps no interference from anyone outside could be an excellent result.
Yeah, that's hoping. I think it's going to take all the rest of this year for this to be sorted out, and we're going to be talking about this on many podcasts to come.
Right. Well, considering that the rest of the year is only about 6 months from the time of this podcast, I think you're being quite optimistic.
You know, I have to ask you, though, in your opinion, at this point, if someone is looking at moving into EB-5 and they are looking at the uncertainty of what to do, plus the fact that there seems to be an enormous expense moving forward of running a regional center, setting one up, why bother? Do you still see that there's a point?
I think we have to look at the individual projects and individual people and look that they're doing it for the right reasons. If they're doing it simply
point,
to be another one who can maybe take a rent-a-center on or that type of thing, I don't think it'd be wise for them to do it. There's too much regulatory control and reporting requirements and expense just to keep it running. So if there's somebody who's really into projects, like some of the very big ones that we know in the industry, those folks will have to renew or, if they have new projects, new ideas, start new regional centers. Those who've been dragging along simply as let's hope and see if we can make some quick money, those folks will be ill-advised to even attempt this at this time.
I do see what you're saying, but I am not in favor of letting the big corporate and big regional centers I'm classing as big corporate have the only say here. I do like to see diversity, and I think that's what keeps the market fresh because there are different types of projects. And so I'm looking at perhaps different types of rent-a-center type of things. And so it's not just a rent-a-center where you don't care, but it's a center where, yes, you can rent it, but the center itself has a lot of oversight.
Right. Well, I think I may have not clearly stated. If there is a project, it works. It's not a size of project. If there's a real project, certainly go ahead. It makes sense, particularly in the light of what's happening in the marketplace with inflation and interest rates going up. It's once again going to become a low interest rate project that the developers will go for. And I see the banks tightening up on loans again. So we'll have a repeat of some years back when it created effectively a boom in EB-5. And whether you were big or small, you could take advantage of it. My idea is simply don't deal with regional centers that just do it for the hell of it and hope to make some money sometime.
Yeah,
with real projects. Size is not the issue. It's just real projects.
I totally agree with you because we have a lot of experience with smaller projects and in different industries. And there were so many industries, even after the, you know, a few years back, even when there was a lot of money being flowed into the market, there were some industries which were just not getting that kind of money. Or if they were getting it, it was in double digits. So they really did benefit from EB-5 capital. But anyway, I do want to ask you because right now everybody has an opinion. And of course, you have an opinion, I have an opinion, and there are different schools of thought from the people who are used to putting up regional centers. And most of us have not really put up a regional center for at least a couple of years because of COVID. and et cetera. One opinion on the market is you put in everything but the kitchen sink. Then you have another opinion of skeletal or a minimal filing. What is your opinion at this point?
Well, this goes under the heading of two attorneys, three opinions. My personal sense is that we know what it says in the actual act. We don't know what the regulations have. We know what it says in the form itself.
Well, knowing what it says in the form itself, do you have any advice for EB5 practitioners right now?
I would look to meet every single item that is mentioned there in my filing. So it is a very full filing that I would advise. I'm also advising holding off from filing for a short while to see if some clarity comes out in the next few weeks. But my bottom line is a full and complete application. In my opinion, bare bones has a very high risk of a straight out denial. I don't think they're going to tolerate that. And something that's in the middle is going to result in a huge RFE. I don't think that the full filing will get you out of an RFE, but I think it'll be a more manageable RFE.
Yeah, I know there are a lot of opinions out there that everybody is going to be RFE'd. And I know, Mark, you're going to say, stop using acronyms, RFE, Request for Additional Evidence.
Oh, we know that one. Unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't know who doesn't. But the RFEs themselves can slow you down. But I think that USCIS are going to RFE. I do agree with that point. They will RFE, but it's the size of the RFE and if it's something minimal coming back. But here's the other issue. If we suggest that, yes, we should have a full filing rather than a skeletal, do you think that it's opening the doors, A, to showing USCIS how we want to, or setting the standard ourselves, and a full filing will inevitably slow USCIS down?
Well, I don't think we've ever influenced immigration in which way it's going to go, so I don't think this will. And in fact, I'd say that if they think it's too much, they'll be sure to try and cut it down, because as much as they don't do work, they also don't like work. So if they can keep things a little more simple, I think that's what they will do with their regs and with their policy statements.
Yeah, you've been through some of the forms and stuff. Now, although we're not going into the forms themselves at this point, do you think that some of these questions that they're asking are sort of not as detailed as the previous form? As I seem to think, I think it's open-ended, some of the questions.
Yeah, you're correct, and I believe this is a result of having rushed this form through. My biggest surprise last week was to see a form on Friday the 13th before the 14th deadline. I absolutely never expected it, and therefore it clearly got rushed. So I think that more thought will go into it, and we can see updates on those forms as time goes on.
So you really think that they just rushed to get it out there because they knew that if they didn't, there would be more lawsuits?
Well, if not lawsuits, there'd be one big fuss about it. And yeah. I think they've got enough on their plates at this time with so many other issues that they probably got a directive, get that form out on time or else.
Mm. I think that there's going to be a lot there where they're going to see, okay, these people have previously been designated, they have things running. I do think, you know, USCIS is going to use their discretion there, even though there is this idea that everybody starts afresh.
Well, I certainly hope so, but unfortunately, I'm pretty skeptical about the way these things get done, and I see them trying to set the new standard, and everybody must now meet that new standard and supply all the information and documents. And oh, by the way, we did this for the last 20 years and really successfully without a complaint, is not going to carry as much weight as it should. It will obviously have some influence, because if we take the big names, they've been doing it so often, just their names carry a lot of credibility.
Yeah. Do you think USCIS have drafted a specific what's called 956, that's the form, right? 956 worksheet for adjudicators? Do you have any idea? Or have you seen what's on that?
No. Firstly, they have to make one because that's how they work. But whether one's ready or not, I have strong doubts because of the rush of this form. I think that was next in line, perhaps, and maybe they're doing it now. But when they get to do that, they're probably going to see what's missing in the form, and that's going to generate the updated form I mentioned a moment ago.
Mm. You know, Suzanne, in her wonderful blog, thought that you would not see a single approval this year. I don't know. Maybe she's being overly pessimistic.
I find that Suzanne is very bright, very intuitive, and I have no doubt that most of these things she predicts will be the way it comes out if we're lucky enough to get within those dates.
So you do think that we may not see an approval this year? That means no one will be able to file a regional center case until 2023?
That's my true feeling, yes.
Wow.
The whole thing is the brakes are on this regional center story because of this interpretation, which could easily be changed by immigration if they chose to, because it's within their power to say, let's go ahead and do what we've been doing and give some breath of life, even if it is on a form that you say, I've been this all this time, I filed all my annual returns, and I want to continue, and I promise to do everything that's said in the new law. And they may well do that, but I'm not holding my breath on it. That would be the correct way to go from an efficiency and business point of view, neither of which are adjectives that are currently attached to immigration.
I know. We never have anything very nice to say about them, do we? You know, and right now they are so frustrating. But here's my point, though. What about all those people who are desperate to file because of maybe age out children or whatever? Would they just have to rely on the direct program?
Well, we know that the direct program is there and it will give them a level of certainty. If they're waiting on an age out, I would say don't wait. Get into something that will lock in that age under CSPA, that's the Child Status Protection Act, and be sure not to miss that opportunity. So I would say don't rely on things coming through if your child is aging out in the next, say, 12 months.
Yeah, and I think it also does give a huge advantage for anybody who has a direct project in the rural locations, because under the new rule, the rural locations have a separate set-aside in their visas. So anyone in that category will be first in line.
Yes, that is, and particularly for China, where they are backlogged on their visa numbers, this will give the Chinese a great advantage. We're already experiencing a rush of inquiries in that regard. But I think of note is something that came up the other day, which seems to be confirmed. There's a requirement in the new law that rural gets preferred adjudication attention, but it's written in a place where it relates only to the regional centers. So that the current interpretation by our colleagues is that the rushed adjudication does not apply to direct investment.
Well, that's something good to keep in mind, David, but is there a flip side to that?
The contrary to that is that somebody has recently received approvals on directs, and on that basis, perhaps they don't have anything else to do in the area, so they're doing what they've got because there aren't any regional center ones to give the preference to. Or they just haven't noticed the distinction in the two categories.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. You're back to your two lawyers, three opinions. There's so many ways to interpret what was written. And I'm sure we are still going to be talking about something, even if USCIS give their opinion, because we won't agree with their opinion, of course. Because we always think we're cleverer than USCIS.
Right. Well, you know, that aside, I have had some excellent experiences with USCIS, so I can't keep knocking them all away. unfortunately, of late and through the last administration, and unfortunately it also carried forward somewhat into this administration, it has been, from a practitioner and an investor or client's point of view, a total nightmare.
Well, getting back to the actual recertification process, David, can anyone now file for a regional center designation, even if you had no previous experience?
I think there are two issues here. One is not everyone can file because only U.S. permanent residents and citizens can file and be involved in a regional center. And the previous experience, I'm actually not sure on that one. I would imagine that they're looking at experience and the ability of the individuals to actually do the work. So perhaps you can elaborate a little more than I have in front of me now, Mona.
I can answer the second question, because if they're going to take the same policy that they have been, they've been very tough on people who are new coming in. They want to make sure that they have access to, you know, all the updates and everything, especially if someone has no way of even, or no interest in even going into the EB5 world and knowing what's happening. So we have seen very strict RFEs This was pre-COVID, obviously, when we were putting regional centers up. Very strict RFEs relating to how are you going to have the knowledge to move forward? How are you going to sort out your investors and just stay abreast of what's happening? So I think that anyone without experience would need to maybe tie in with someone with experience.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. The principle of it, I don't agree with you. Take someone like Elon Musk, who knew nothing about cars, and look what he's built. But at the same time, I think for the industry, it's important that people who do come in have an ability to run it and don't run us into all of the negativity that came out of the dishonest and incompetent activities of the past.
Yeah, that's true. So you have to have a green card or be a U.S. citizen to operate a regional center. But I did notice on the forms that even if you're a part of a JC or an NCE, they're requesting copies of your green card. Now, that's not in the law, but it's on the form.
I didn't notice that, but that's, you know, usual sort of overreaching by our agency. And there may be some good argument for it, but I would guess that if they put out regulations like that, no court's going to stop them from asking for it, because they'll raise issues like national security and things that no one can answer.
Well, we've added the experience as well, though, that when you have fully overseas members and they have control of the project, it can be very dangerous because there's no way to force them to do anything. Even if you start a lawsuit, it's very hard to, you know, get what you want doing if somebody's overseas. I mean, first of all, it's very hard even to serve the person if they're overseas, right, and let alone, you know, force them. So I do see the point of that. But speaking of lawsuits, there is a Bering lawsuit. Again, they're out there suing. And we talked about this in a podcast a couple of weeks ago. Do you see any success? Because previously they were successful. So I know there are people out there who are saying, okay, let's just wait. I'm sure that the lawsuit's going to win and we don't have to do this.
Yes. First of all, I know the Bering guys and they are a great group of people and they do this with the right intention. I have doubts, though, that this round is going to be successful like the last one where they did win. There's just too much out there and there's a whole lot of, seems to me in listening, sort of resistance by the court to want to jump in on this. I think that they're going to have a lot of difficulty. The court even rejected the letter from the congressionals who wrote saying it is the intention. They said it's not for us to review even. So I think we're going to have a lot of difficulty with those lawsuits, and I wouldn't hang my hat on them. I wouldn't wait for them. I would govern my actions according to what we can see today without hope on that lawsuit outcome.
Yeah, good advice. I agree. I feel like I'm coming full circle here, David, because I'm going back to Grassley's full statement. But I have to say, there have been a number of opinions which have been voiced to USCIS that whatever they're doing right now is going to kill the market. I personally don't agree. We have seen this in other countries like the UK and Canada, where they keep closing programs and stuff. It doesn't seem to stop people wanting to come. And as soon as everything is opened out again, people seem to just want to rush back in.
Well, you know, U.S. is the number one country for most other countries coming here for education, for our system of government, for due process, all of that sort of stuff, which they don't have in their home countries. I have not seen a total switch off over the last years, even with what has been going on. And I have seen in the recent months a resurgence of the energy and the desire to get involved with EB-5 that I hadn't seen for several years. So I believe that whatever goes on in this program is certainly going to survive, and the net result will be a terrific program for everyone. Everyone who is involved in it should make a success of it, from the investors through the developers, through the regional centers, and then all the service providers, which includes us attorneys. So I see very positive outcome. It's a bright light in the future, and I'm looking forward to participate in it. We, in fact, are staffing up in anticipation because we know that there's so much work coming down. We have so many inquiries and actual retaining of us for some really big work. So it's happening, and it's going to happen.
I totally agree with you. In my opinion, I know people will hate me for this, but in my opinion, I feel like this period is necessary. And it's sad that if you really need to make money, you can't make money right now as far as filing new cases are concerned. And it is a little tough for people, but it is overall this, bringing the whole Integrity Act is giving confidence to overseas people who are seeing that, all right, the US government are stepping in. They're trying to do their best. They don't want to take over. This is not a government program in that way, like it is in other countries. It is still a private project, you know, sort of scenario that we're seeing, but the US government is coming in to see how much they can actually stop fraud and waste and all of those things. A little like how the SEC jumped in a few years ago.
Manu, you have an amazing skill to create controversy, and you say people hate you. They actually don't hate you. They get challenged by what you say, and I think that what you say is challenging. Sometimes I actually do agree with you, and sometimes I do not. But I see that it's necessary for the government to have these controls for the stability of the program. And yes, it's going to take a bit of time and it's not going to please a lot of people. But when it gets going, I think it's going to be a fine program.
Yep, I couldn't agree more.
Well, Mona and David, I like what you both have said about the stability of the program, how much it's needed, and how there needed to be some controls put in place, and how obviously that may put off some people right now because it's causing a slowdown. It's like in the energy industry. I just watched a show on Netflix about Three Mile Island. And, you know, you have a reactor that is in an unsafe state. You have to shut it down, put controls in place, know where you're at before you start it up again, before you start generating some useful energy. Otherwise, you'll have a meltdown. And we don't want a meltdown on the EB5.
Oh, really, Mark? You have to do better than that. But, you know, David, we've had our meltdown already, right?
Yes, absolutely. And fortunately, we will recover in a lot less time than it will take to take care of a nuclear meltdown. And we are in the recovery mode.
Yeah, although it may feel like thousands of years, the next couple of weeks, it's not actually that long.
Yeah.
Well, Mona, I think that's a good start in talking about recertifying regional centers, but we didn't mention offering documents at all.
Do you know how long that's going to take, Mark? We can't do
right at the end.
Yeah, nope. We'll get to that in another episode.
Excellent. We'll save it for the next episode. And by then, we'll probably have more information, right?
Yes, hopefully.
David Herson, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it, and I look forward to future episodes.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.